We want to alert you that some of the content you're about to hear in these podcasts could be upsetting and distressing. So please be aware, this may not be the right moment to listen. I'm Claire English, and in this short series of Child Protection Committee Scotland podcasts, we aim to offer both essential listening and some valuable learning about how we can all do better when it comes to keeping Scotland's children safe. Over the series, we'll talk in depth with our special guests about a broad range of child protection-themed subjects. Our contributors will be sharing their experience and insight, and we'll be learning what we can all do to improve how we protect and care for children who might be at risk of harm. In this edition, we're discussing domestic violence and how it affects children. And this is a subject that needs airing because, according to Scottish Government statistics, the most common reason for children in Scotland to be placed on the at-risk register is domestic violence. To help shine a light on this most challenging aspect of child protection, we asked three guests to share their knowledge and experience with us. I began by asking our contributors to introduce themselves.
I'm John Devaney. I work as a Professor of Social Work at the University of Edinburgh. And I was in social work practice for about 20 years before moving into academia, where I do a lot of research around issues to do with domestic abuse.
Excellent. We're going to learn a lot from you. We have somebody else in the studio with us. Tell us who you are, please.
Hi, I'm Emily. Thanks for inviting me along here today. I'm a survivor of domestic abuse, and through that I've spent a lot of time in child protection and child welfare systems with myself and my family.
Very grateful to see you here today, Emily. It's going to be amazing to have your input as well. And last but not least, we have somebody listening in this conversation a little bit further away from us. But tell us who you are, please.
Hi, I'm Marcia Scott. I'm Chief Exec at Scottish Women's Aid, which is Scotland's national domestic abuse organisation. We have 33 services all around Scotland, and we learn every day from the experiences of women and children on the ground and of staff on the ground, but also we spend a lot of time with academics and social workers, all of us working to improve the response to domestic abuse in Scotland. And I'm also a survivor.
Fantastic. And you will know John, and you're coming at it from a couple of different angles. That's fantastic, Marcia. We're going to learn so much today. So let's start off on this huge subject, and I'll start with you, John. We, I think, as a society, have become more aware of what a huge issue domestic abuse is, and we have probably been in that position for some years now. There's so much of it around the news. Why do you think we haven't heard so much about how domestic abuse affects children?
It's a really good question to start with, Claire, because I think we've been, as a society, on a journey over the past 40 to 50 years where, because of the advocacy of survivors of domestic abuse and people who've been alongside of them, we've started to get an increasing understanding of what are the nature of domestic abuse and what are the ways that it manifests itself and how that impacts, firstly, on adult victims, but more recently, also starting to appreciate the impact that it has on children as victims in their own right. And I think that's definitely because we've had individuals who have been victimized, who are survivors, who have shared their experiences and helped us understand all of that, but also that we've had policymakers and lawmakers who have been open to hearing that and then thinking about, well, what are the types of responses that we can have as a society that would provide, firstly, protection and secondly, support to victims, whether they're adults and children. And research has played a part in all of that, but I think research has come in on the back of all of those advances that have been made by first survivors and then advocates.
Give us an idea of how quickly that change of focus has come. Has that been in very recent years? And what's triggered that, do you think?
I think if we look within the Scottish context, we've certainly seen that there's been a movement that has really worked closely with lawmakers and policymakers to try and think about what's the framework that we need to have, both a legal framework in terms of both protections for victims, but also sanctions for those who perpetrate domestic violence and abuse, but also trying to think about, separate to the justice system, what are the supports that need to be in the community. And a lot of those initial supports were developed by and for survivors of domestic abuse, and that's grown to the sort of that sector really helping other sectors in health and social work elsewhere to think about how they can work in ways which are likely to be helpful to adult and child survivors, whilst also helpfully pointing out sometimes whenever those good intentions have maybe not worked in the way that they should have, and that actually they've put adult and child victims in more difficult situations than they should have been in the first place.
We'll get on to talk about that a little bit later. Marcia, let me ask you, do we actually know how many children in Scotland are affected by domestic abuse?
No, we don't. And if somebody says they do, they're lying. Okay. So there's been estimates. And the last estimate I know, I think the Scottish government quotes 1 in 5 children. And the reason we don't know is because we actually have no accurate measures of the prevalence of domestic abuse. We know that worldwide, it's likely, you know, to be somewhere between 1 in 3 and 1 in 4 women. And I think the estimate of 1 in 5 children in Scotland is probably a good place to start. What you said at the beginning is really the most important thing, which is that we know it's everywhere. It's in every family. It's in every community. It's in every workplace. And so that one of my comments often is, can we stop counting it and start, you know, reducing it? And that has to do with changing the way we make policy, the way we design services, and mostly the way we understand domestic abuse.
Totally get what you're saying there, but I'm actually quite shocked. 1 in 5, that seems much more common than maybe I would have expected. You're not shocked by that?
It really is. And I think the background to that is that domestic abuse isn't something that happens to other families. It's not, perpetrators are not, you know, this small cohort of intensely psychopathic men who just visit their abuse on, you know, dozens, hundreds of women, obviously, with the numbers. So if we're looking at 1 in 4 women and 1 in 5 children, then really, you know, what we need to do is treat this as everyday abuse that's happening instead of some sort of specialist thing that we bolt on services. I had a conversation recently, for instance, with folks in the Crown Office who are prosecuting, and they're really, you know, really good allies for the most part. But they were like, well, you know, domestic abuse is a specific thing and we have to develop a specialist response. And I said, no, you have to develop a competent response because it's the most common thing that comes across your desk when you have to prosecute a crime. So this should be your bread and butter, not your, oh, well, we'll learn to do that when we've done our other stuff.
I'm sure you're making them candidly aware of what your views are on that. And it's very important to have that sort of advocacy because, yes, I think we all sort of, you know, tend to silo things and say, oh, domestic abuse, yeah, that is a problem, but it's not across society or it's not as big as we think. But what I'd like to ask you next, Marcia, is can you outline some of the ways that children can be affected by domestic abuse?
I'm so glad you asked that question. One of the things that it's really, really important to understand about domestic abuse, and especially around the coercive and controlling behaviors that in our experience are a part of every domestic abuse, is that it's 24/7. It's not about what happened last night at 9 o'clock because of the drink. It's about a course of conduct, a multiplicity of behaviors that the outcome is to control. And if you're living in a family with somebody who's has a really high need for control and sometimes uses perhaps physical violence, but always uses some other forms of coercion and control, and you're a child, just imagine how helpless you are in the face of all of that. And children are amazingly resilient when we support them appropriately. But the reality here is that everybody has thought of the impact of domestic abuse on children as something about, well, if the abuser, which in every piece of evidence we have across libraries of evidence, it's we're talking about women who are the mothers who are the non-offending parent and the offending parent is the father. And what we're talking about really here is a regime of control and terror that becomes normalized. And if you're living in that situation, it doesn't matter whether you're in the room when your father's abusing your mother. It doesn't matter if you're in the house or in the country. The reality is you're being controlled in those same ways. And so when somebody talks about, well, did the child witness domestic abuse? It just does my head in, because if they live in a family where there's domestic abuse, they're a victim of domestic abuse. We tried really hard to get that into our law in 2018, which is a great law, much better than previous ones, but we were unable to make children co-victims. It's a real drawback on that law, I think.
That's really important what you've said there about, you know, they always assume it's about witnessing the thing. It's not about how it permeates into every corner of a child's life, is it?
Exactly. And the word witness just drives me crazy. You know, the implication is that somehow children can be unaffected. And what we see, the consequences of that attitude, is that we see abusive fathers who are given unsupervised contact with children because they're good enough fathers, because they aren't convicted of abusing the child. Don't get me wrong. We are not saying that children experiencing domestic abuse should never have contact with their fathers. We don't believe that. But what we do believe is that people who make the decisions about child contact after the parents are no longer living together need to really fully understand the likely impact and be much, much better at listening to what children and their mothers say.
Listening to us just now is Emily. And it's really important that, Emily, you're here today. You are a domestic abuse survivor. Can you, first of all, anything you've heard there that you want to take on and just comment on? Because you were listening very intently to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just follow on from Marcia there. And yeah, absolutely. I think one of the first things that needs to be clear, and it's something that I didn't understand in my own situation, was that if someone is abusing the mother or the parent, they are either directly and or indirectly abusing the children. And I think we do have research and evidence to show that now. Emma Katz, David Mandel, there is lots of literature out there. So we can now make that link. We also know that most of the referrals to child protection registers involve domestic abuse, and also that there's a really high correlation between domestic abuse and child mortality. So I think fundamentally, we really need to start looking, like Marcia said, looking through the domestic abuse lens at all these other systems. And I think it's really important, you know. I think support services are maybe more focused on that. But when it comes to courts and justice services, we still tend to look at an incident or the incident that brought us here. And there's no real understanding or sort of holistic view taken of ongoing abuse. And as Marcia said, you know, that can have real impact on the children just because they're in that situation, because they're living in that situation. And it is often a very extended period of kind of fight or flight. So there was always that anxiety about what's happening, you know, what's going on in the wider sense of court proceedings or what have you. But in addition to that, the abuse and the systems that deal with that tend to make things very difficult for the survivors and families. So they might have to flee their home, they might have to give up employment, and then it becomes more a survival issue than being able to maybe thrive.
Mm.
So, you know, you're constantly in limbo with that whole situation and things being dealt with. And then, you know, as I think both mentioned, the sort of gendered view of parenting. So we still have much higher expectations for mothers. The fathers simply need to say they have parental rights. And I think, again, if we were to look at that through the whole lens of, you know, this pivot to the perpetrator, safe and together, the whole lens of the pattern of abuse, the pattern of control, and the ongoing impact that has for families. I think that's where we need to get to.
Gosh, you've given us so much to think about. John, you've been, we are going to ask you about your situation, if you will, in a moment. But John was scribbling away notes furiously. Don't know what you're up to, Marcia, but go on, John.
Yeah, I would agree with everything Emily said. One of the things that we know is that each child is unique. But in responding from services, from professionals, there can be the tendency to think about what are the child's needs at this moment in time and think about what are the impacts currently on a child without thinking about what are the long-term consequences for a child of having been experienced domestic abuse. And quite often when services respond, they focus very much on physical safety, both of the adult and the child.
The immediate threat.
The immediate threat, the immediate physical safety, and that is extremely important. But if that's where the response stops, then what about the psychological safety? And what about the long-term need for support for adults and children in terms of recovery, in terms of understanding what they've been through, trying to move forward in their lives and trying to do that in a way where they feel psychologically safe as well as physically safe? And I think that's one of the things that we've learned over the past 20 years from speaking to children who've been exposed to domestic abuse and also speaking to their mothers about the importance of psychological safety alongside physical safety and about longer term recovery work, rather than just thinking if we get in, the people separate, then it'll be all right. And quite often that's not the case. And the danger in that is that if we think, well, if adult victims won't separate, well, actually, they're not putting their child's needs first. And actually, when we talk about that uniqueness of children's experiences, we have some children who, at the very worst end, have experienced a parent being killed by their father or their mother. And what we've probably failed to grasp in some of those situations is the risk that the adult and child victim knew that they were at, and to hear that assessment of their own threat rather than assuming that as professionals, we don't need to listen to them because we've got a better knowledge about how to undertake risk assessment and that we can do that without fully engaging with the lived experience of those who are in the middle of it.
God, we're going to try and talk a little bit later about how services can improve and how we listen more and understand more, but we need to hear from somebody that's been through it. And you were just talking there, Emily, in the wider sense. What about if you can bear to, and it is a big ask, can you tell us a little bit about how the situation was for you and then how it affected your children?
So it was really difficult, I'm not going to lie. My situation started maybe about 8-9 years ago when there had been incidents of domestic abuse, and then ultimately there was an incident of child abuse. And unfortunately, it was that incident that was the catalyst for services stepping in. I say unfortunately because the incident completely ripped the family apart. It was good, obviously, that people were then recognising, you know, there's danger here, there is a risk here. But I mean, it had a huge effect on me and my children. It's extremely stressful, especially when a lot of, we were involved in the children's panel, for example, for years, and a lot of the meetings at the children's panel were called by the father. So in a lot of ways, we were still kind of dancing to his tune, and he would demand meetings, he would demand appeals, and this went on for years and years.
So the balance of power was still...
The balance of power. This gender division is still really obvious. And like I say, he could simply do this because he had rights. And we still, I think, go sometimes wrongly on the presumption that contact is a good thing. You know, as I was saying earlier, I think the key consideration is safety. And, you know, if we've got someone who is a risk to women and children, why are we spending years considering if they can have contact? And yet I found it really harrowing. And like I say, it split the family because my eldest child then had to go and live somewhere else. So I had three siblings. They were split up. I'm left in a position where I'm trying to protect them, but I'm also having to explain why I'm doing that, you know, so that it's, like I say, a lot of the systems are weighted on what maybe prima facie looks okay. So you're looking at, should the child have contact? Is it, you know, trying to keep that bond with both parents? But in my situation, we're talking about a convicted Schedule 1 offender who had been convicted of many other offences, and I'm still having to persuade people that he shouldn't have contact. And you have to think, there has to be a line somewhere that somebody just says, no, you know, enough. And luckily, I did have support in that from social work, from child protection, from Women's Aid. And there was a an indeterminate period, it's still in place, of no contact with the father. But that was a real fight for me.
And when you're at your lowest ebb as well, how are you able to gather the resources to deal with that on top of what you've already got?
And bearing in mind that one of my children is no longer with me. And
you've been separated from a child.
To manage that, I mean, that's devastating. And the sad thing about that was, because this child was then living most of the time in another area, they were never considered. So I had to go to these meetings and say, but remember, you know, we still have the sister, my daughter, there's still someone else here. But that was completely ignored. So I think we really need to take this holistic approach about the overall impact on the family, because we know that abusers isolate victims. They destroy other family and friend supports. And I think that's something to bear in mind as well when we're looking at the sort of risk and, you know, how we manage these situations.
This is all new to me, but Marcia, you're sitting there. You must know, how common is this story?
Thank you for being willing to talk about that. I think that there's so many things that I want to pick up on that I'm struggling a little bit to focus. But I guess one of the things is to come back to what you were saying, and it linked to what John was saying too. There's a couple of themes where if people have this fundamental misunderstanding of what's happening with children, child protection and domestic abuse, and if we could clear that up, everybody would find it so much easier to respond helpfully. And I think one of these things is that separation equals safety. And this whole notion that once the partners, the abuser and the abused are separated, that the system can, you know, wash its hands of it all, of responsibility for protecting the children and the survivors in general. And we get data from our helpline, which takes about 12 to 15,000 calls a year. So this is a really rich data set, as well, of course, as what we hear from our 33 services. And the single biggest reason around legal issues and legal questions that women contact our helpline is because they are in this iniquitous position where either Children's Hearing System or the Sheriff Court is demanding that they cooperate in having their children have contact with what is essentially a dangerous father. And because of the gender inequality that threads through all of the elements of our lives, he's so much more likely to have access to a lawyer, to have the money to manipulate the legal systems. Women, especially now in our, you know, dearth of access to justice for women, are often having to represent themselves in cases where they've already been traumatized, in rooms where the abuser is there, you know, because the failure to understand how all of these things come together and then continue and sometimes often get worse after separation. So when social workers have said to many of the women, and social workers, don't get me wrong, oh my God, hardest job in the world, maybe after teachers. No, after helpline call handlers. But anyway, you know, you have to have the tools to do your craft. And the tools for understanding what to do when you see a domestic abuse situation, you don't really understand that, as David Mandel of Safe and Together says, that domestic abuse in a family where there are children is a parenting choice. and that separation doesn't equal safety. And you feel like your hands are tied. What are you going to do to protect the children? And so often then, really well-meant advice is, well, you're not able to protect your children while you're living with him, so you really need to leave him. And then, of course, that's the most dangerous advice you can give somebody.
Explain why that's the most dangerous advice. Is it because at the point when you choose to leave is when you're more vulnerable?
Well, no, it's not when you're more vulnerable. It's when the abuser ups his coercive and controlling tactics. It isn't about her, it's about him.
Yeah.
So the reality is that, the time that women and children are in the most danger is when they begin to try and reduce the control the abuser has over them, whether that's through saying, I want you to move out, which hardly ever happens, or whether it's through, if you don't stop these behaviors, I'm going to have to call the police, or, I want a divorce, or any of the things that can happen. And one of the things that's really important to remember is that perpetrators have very individual patterns of abuse. And I think Emily was touching on this, which is that, in one case, it'll look one way, and in another case, it'll look another. And the only way you know exactly what's going on is if, A, the system is looking very closely at his behavior rather than at the mother's behavior. Also, if you ask and listen really carefully to what they tell you about what he does that is harmful or threatening, because it doesn't look the same. And until you understand that your job is often not to intervene, but to listen and get more information until you know how to intervene most safely, then it's really hard to be helpful. And
yeah.
I think in the context of separation not equaling safety, telling somebody that they should leave is probably the worst thing you can do, but rather saying, can we talk about what we can do that will help support you? Because we know you're trying to protect your children.
We're far from getting it right when it comes to giving the right sort of support. But John was listening to Emily there, and now he's listening to you. And I want to bring you in, John.
Yeah, just picking up on the points that Emily and Marcia have made, I think that there have been improvements in practice. So I speak to social workers, teachers, police officers, health visitors who are involved with families. And as Emily has said, actually, they can work really hard at trying to make sure they give the right support. But sometimes, as Marcia's mentioned, they don't feel as though they've got the tools. But one of the things that's come across from the research I've been involved in and from speaking to both practitioners and survivors has been that, firstly, we need to recognise that when we talk about those who perpetrate domestic violence and abuse, they can have a range of motivations for why they behave the way that they do, and what they do in terms of how they behave can be very varied. So you can have somebody who's violent and aggressive and abusive within their family, but also with everybody else that they come into contact with in their life. So they're just generally an antisocial person who finds it very difficult to have a relationship with anyone that's not mediated by violence or control. Another presentation can be that you have young people in their first romantic relationships who maybe have sort of learnt how you engage with others in an intimate way through watching pornography, and therefore in that very first intimate relationship, they behave in ways which are very inappropriate. But actually, that's an opportunity to try and help them to sort of reflect upon their behaviour and think about how they behave differently, so they don't have a lifetime of behaving this way, but actually they've got off on the wrong foot and need intervention at that stage that can help them think about how they behave much more appropriately in those relationships. And then you can have other individuals who are the pillar of society. Everybody thinks that they're well-respected in work, they're well-respected in the community, but they're very controlling and manipulative of their partner and their children. And nobody sees that from the outside. All they see is somebody who's very caring and attentive to their family's needs and wanting to protect them from that big bad world outside. But in reality, they're just very controlling about who their partner, who their children can have contact with, what they can do, what access to funds they might be able to have. And actually, all of these things, what they point to is something Marcia mentioned about the importance of carrying out a proper assessment by professionals who may be in contact with children and with adults. So that means actually spending time doing direct work with children to understand from a child's perspective what is their experience of daily life, because it may be bad all of the time, or it may be worse at particular moments in time, and understanding that can be important for assessing how we might intervene in ways that are likely to be helpful. So, for example, if we know that actually somebody is very controlling, but actually that becomes worse, whenever they've been drinking or at certain other times. That might mean that that feeds into how we do safety planning with children and with adult victims about when are the most risky periods and how do we try and think about who else might be around.
So many variables to consider. It's such a difficult job to try to assess accurately and compassionately as well. But if we are talking about just protecting children and supporting children, we also have to think, John, about the age, stage and gender of the child. Can you explain a bit more about that?
Yes, I think every child's unique. We'll all know from our own families or from other people's families that actually our children within the same family can all have their own personalities and needs. So no two children will experience domestic abuse in the same way or react or be impacted in the same way. That's not to say that we don't have some general understandings now of the way in which children are impacted and how we should respond. So for very young children, we know that they need to feel as though they've got a secure base and attachment with one or both parents, that they feel that sort of that sense of security allows them to explore the world around them and have that sense that when they encounter something which is strange or maybe even threatening, that they've got these secure and safe people in their lives that they can go to that will protect them and help them navigate anything that's upsetting in the world. But actually, if those safe people are actually not safe to you as a child, who else do you turn to? And that may leave you, as Emily has said earlier on, feeling as though the world in its entirety is a very unsafe place, and therefore you become very cautious and wary of everyone and everything. And that's not helpful the longer that that goes on for. So therefore we know that children who are likely to be most impacted are those where the violence and abuse starts when they're very young, and where it lasts for a long time, and where the control or abuse is more severe. And therefore, that points to the need to intervene at as early a stage as possible to support the adult victim and to protect the relationship between the adult victim, the mother, and their children. Because as Emily has said earlier on, the danger is that a perpetrator can very much try and drive a wedge between the adult victim and the child victim, and to sort of portray the adult victim as not being able to meet the child's needs, when usually adult victims, mothers are working overtime to try and minimise the impact on their children and to protect their children from what's going on in the relationship, whilst at the same time feeling very unsafe themselves.
That balancing act, Emily, how the heck do you get the resources to deal with that, apart from, as we've said earlier, dealing with your own trauma and the physical and mental abuse that you're facing?
Yeah, it's really hard. And I think you can only really get to that place when the abuse stops. You know, and I think what we find in a lot of cases is when people have separated from domestic abusers, they may still face that post-separation abuse. So there can be lots of things happening round about. Like, for example, making complaints to the police, false complaints. I mean, you know, making things up, phoning the police, phoning social work, phoning child protection, causing issues with people who support you. In my own experience, my lawyer, my childminder, my women's aid worker, and my employers were all subject to complaints and harassment by the abuser because he didn't like that, you know, they're in my side and they're supporting me. So he did everything he could to destroy those relationships and to get those people into trouble
so
as well.
So you're isolated on every front.
Yeah. And I think the things that make a real difference are the instruments we can use to protect the women and children. So like maybe non-harassment orders, exclusion orders, things that the perpetrator possibly might just ignore anyway. However, there are remedies for that. And that's when it becomes sort of police and, you know, criminal matter. And I think that's probably the most effective way to stop some of these tactics by abusers is when they are, you know, it's taken a step further and they're taken to court themselves about their behaviours, not the domestic abuse, but the other behaviours, for example, contempt of court, breaching bail, that kind of thing.
John's wanting to jump in here.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's because it's really important, Emily, that you've talked about what happens post-separation, because I think there's a tendency for services to think that sort of once people have separated, job done, the physical safety is in place. But actually, there's a lot of learning that we've gained about technology-facilitated abuse that continues post-separation. So the fact that people can still be tracked on their mobile phones, people may have planted a tracker in their car, about being able to sort of still stalk them through social media. And actually, all these things, I think, as professionals and services, we struggle to think about what can we do in that instance.
And what can you do in that instance?
To survivors, well, change your phone, get a different car. Actually, this is all costs phenomenal amounts of money.
And it's always the burden on the survivor and the family.
That's right. And and that extends to children as well. That sort of dads can say, oh, well, I want to make sure that I know where my children are. Because even if, especially now that I'm not living with them.
So there's almost a built-in excuse to say, I need to survey my child more closely.
That's right. And actually, doing that and presenting that as being a caring parent because I want to sort of provide care to my children even if they're not living with me is really, in some instances, not all instances, but in enough instances, a way of trying to surveil and monitor and control their ex-partner.
Yeah, I think you have to really be aware of all these really insidious behaviours that don't look like much, but actually they're driven by the control and the manipulation.
Are you constantly on your guard? Are you, you know, hyper-vigilant for any threat? Because now we have this social media thing, and not social media, you know, technology chucked into the equation as well. It's not just physically being able to turn up or intimidate or do it.
It's such an important point, talking about hypervigilance, and well before technology, that was one of the things that we've seen for years in survivors of domestic abuse, which is they become hypervigilant, which, you know, is helpful in when you're living with abuse, but not so good for your stress situation as, you know, through the rest of life. But I do think that in terms of technology and what John was saying, there's a terrible tendency, as has been pointed out, not only to recommend things that cost money, but also that recommend that women have to, you know, shrink their access and, you know, they can't be on Facebook. They can't.
They don't have their profile. They can't have a freedom. Yeah.
Right. It's somehow it's as if they should be controlling their risk rather than the system should be responding to the abuser. And, you know, the way we like to think of it is it's not, oh, suddenly there's this new abuse. Really, what happens with abusers for the most part is that they abuse in a sort of seamless way, online, offline, because it's all about control and information and threat and fear. But in terms of the technology, I think it's really important that we understand that it is also a really helpful area for gathering evidence about abuse. And one of the things that can happen in terms of controlling abusers' use of technology is if we ask our police to do a better job of looking for that evidence when they do a police call on domestic abuse, and for the Crown to look for that evidence and to prosecute it, because then there are measures that are open to the courts that control the abuser's access rather than the asking the victim to shrink her human rights, to shrink her access to support also often, because lots of folks now use internet-facilitated support. So I think that, you know, it's a thread that runs through everything. Stop asking her to do the job that policing, that social work, that, you know, prosecution, the courts should be doing, which is to understand what he's doing.
That's really important. And that's news to me as well. I'm just thinking, I would have thought that ordinarily the police or social work would be looking at those evidence trails. With the technology, you're saying basically it doesn't happen and the onus is still put on the person that's being abused. Yeah?
I wouldn't say it doesn't happen, but I think
not
it's
enough.
Really, I mean, John pointed out that the system is still heavily weighted in terms of think about domestic abuse as physical violence. And so if that You know, that's the first thing they look for. And if they can't find that, then they go, oh, well, I guess coercive control is illegal in Scotland, so maybe we'll look at some of that. But actually, they're all intertwined in each other. There tends to be a focus, as we've been saying, on physical safety. So if a police officer goes to a police call and she or he doesn't see any indications that there's been physical violence, they're less likely to spend time there. They're less likely to do a more sophisticated risk assessment and to get more information, when in fact we know that coercive and controlling behaviors are really probably the single biggest indicator of lethality. So, you know, the use of technology is a great tool in terms of gathering evidence. I've had prosecutors talk about the fact that under the new law, there's so much more evidence they can bring in to the courtroom because, you know, we just had an example of the Stuart Hogg case where he sent 200 texts to his wife, you know, within the space of 4 hours. That's all on her phone. You know, all of this is evidence. And so, but, you know, women, our experience is women know this and they've been offering it to a system that's blind to it.
There's so much we could talk about, but I'm going to bring it back to Emily and find out what the situation is now, because I don't know how long ago you went through all that awful turmoil. You continue to go through it. It's not like it just disappears into the ether. But how are you and how are your children now?
Better. But I think that's another thing that's maybe misunderstood, is that it's a new normal. It's, you know, you don't recover. There's always these experiences that have fundamentally changed you. And, you know, we were talking there about sort of being hypervigilant, being constantly on alert. And while that can reduce, I don't think it ever leaves you. And, you know, that's the other thing that impacts on the children, is that sense of always being very aware of what's going on, of, you know, being in a safe place or being able to call for help if you need. And yeah, and I think, you know, as Marcia was saying, there are a lot more ways to address behaviours now, but it can be very, very hard to get a conviction. And I think that's sometimes where the police fall down, in that they will try to take a matter to court, but then there's going to be no corroboration, not enough evidence, and it just becomes almost a waste of everybody's time. But the sad thing about that, and I'm sure everyone will agree, that when perpetrators commit these acts, whether it's contacting a child that they shouldn't or, you know, causing some distress to the mother, if they are not convicted, they're empowered. So the more times they do this and the more times they get off with it, just keeps that cycle going. And I really do believe that it's a very early intervention, but that we should get that part right, to do with the protection of the children, the protection of the family and the conviction. And again, it's all about that look at the perpetrator. The focus should be on the perpetrator. And then all the supports can be helpful for the family going forward.
We will look to the future in a second, but just before we do that, you know, what was the single most important thing for you when you needed support at the time?
Somebody who understood. And I have to say, it was a women's aid worker who was in that place with me. I suffered a lot of coercive and controlling behaviour, a person who was extremely aggressive with everyone. Well, there was still a lot of victim blaming. There was still a lot of, you know, well, why were you there? Why did you get into that relationship? Why did you not get out of that relationship? And there's still that real misunderstanding that, well, actually, when someone's using control over you, you can't make your own choices. So, yeah, it's been tough.
Having someone to know instinctively what you've gone
just
through.
To understand the difficulties.
Marcia, I mean, we've talked a lot about the problems. Well, maybe we'll start with that and just say, what has improved and what needs to improve more, so that we can sort of round this up a little bit. So give us some sense of optimism that we are making some inroads for people like Emily.
We talk a lot about the problems in the system because that's our job. Our job is to make women and children's lives better, safer, less unequal, But there's lots of reasons to be optimistic in Scotland particularly. I mean, we have the world's gold standard domestic abuse law. It's far from working the way it was designed to, and we're all working hard to improve that. And we have leadership in the police and in the Crown Office who are really committed, somewhat on the back of some not very favorable inspections recently, but who are really committed to change. So we just need to take this window of opportunity before it closes and help everybody challenge the myths that are out there, challenge their own prejudices about what women should do and what men should do and what children should be like and what rights they should have. And we also were the country in the UK that has incorporated the Convention on the Rights of the Child. So there's so much enabling our change here. And so we really have to be brave. We have to be brave to talk about what's not changing and what's actually still happening to women and children every day as we are speaking right now.
So for you, what's the priority then for what needs to change soonest?
Well, I think in this conversation, piggybacking on what Emily was saying is, what do women and children say they need the most? Well, women need somebody who believes them and understands coercive control and domestic abuse generally. And if that's not the chief focus of your social work training, if you're in child protection, then that's one of the areas we can really improve. And John will talk about the challenge of social work curricula, I'm sure. So I'll leave that one to you, John. So that's the first thing. Do you know what your local women's aid organization does? Do you have contacts? Do you talk to them? Do you know that they have a children's service? You know, all of those things, they're really practical and the most helpful things that you can do for the caseload that you have now and you're likely to have. And then also, whether the police gather the right evidence, whether it ever goes to court, exactly what Emily was saying, which is your job is to find out, to get more information. Evan Stark, who wrote the book Coercive Control, literally and figuratively, said something that has always stuck with me, which is, he said, well, when you listen to a woman's story or a child's story, and it's paradoxical to you, it doesn't make any sense, you have two options. You can decide that they're lying or they're crazy, or you can decide that with the information you have, it doesn't make sense, and you can ask for more information. And I think that's the biggest take home is ask more, find out more. And that's so hard when all of us, our scarcest resource is time. But part of what I was saying before about domestic abuse should be everybody's bread and butter work is that if we just build in the time we need to ask the questions and then help people understand what it is they should understand in order to help best, that's really helpful. And then I think the other thing is Safe and Together. Safe and Together is a brilliant, brilliant tool for supporting and giving social workers those tools that they haven't had.
Explain what that is, just outline that.
Yeah. So Safe and Together is an approach that does exactly what it says on the tin, Safe and Together. So keeping children and women safe in child welfare systems, particularly partnering with a non-offending parent, right? So partnering with the mom, understanding and being really clear, what are the protective actions that she's taking that the system tends to be blind to, and supporting that, and keeping her together with her children? Because we know all the evidence is that the single most important protective factor for most children is their relationship with their primary caregiver or their mom. But the other thing that we can do is to, and I heard the word, Emily, pivot our focus onto the behaviors of the perpetrator and stop expecting the people with the least power in the situation to have the most responsibility for safety and start looking at what perpetrators are doing, understanding the abuse there, and putting in mechanisms that will actually benefit, like helping women and children stay in their own homes so that they don't have to become homeless, so they don't have to move to a refuge, so that they don't have to lose their ties with their teachers and their friends and their families. You know, those are very concrete things that we can do that will just make an enormous difference.
Great food for thought there. What a list. What a to-do list that is. John, and let's do what Marcia said. Lob it over to you now. What has improved? Give us some cause for hope. And what needs attention right now?
Yeah, on a very important level, very specific one. We know that the number of adults who die as a result of intimate partner homicide has decreased over the past 30 to 40 years. So it's moved in the right direction, even if we've got more as a society to do in that regard.
Is that because people are recognising it and intervening more quickly?
That's right. We've laws and strategies in place and individual practitioners who are now much more responsive to the issue. So we definitely are. All of those efforts that Marcia, that Emily and others have been involved in have led to a greater awareness of both that this is something we should as a society respond to and also better ways of trying to respond. So I think there is definitely hope. And I think we've also got a much stronger evidence base to tell us what help looks like and how we deliver that in ways which are likely to be experienced as helpful by adults and by children experiencing domestic abuse. We might not always do it, but at least we know what we could and should do in those circumstances, which leads me on to think about sort of four key things that I think would be helpful moving forward. The first is about putting services for adult and child victims, putting those support services on a more secure financial footing. We put a lot of money into addressing the issue of domestic violence through the police, through the courts.
Criminal justice gets the largest share
of all of that. And so it's not to say to take money away from that, because as Emily's already said, it's really important that we have strong laws and those laws are enforced. But also we need to ensure that women and children who are experiencing domestic violence and support do know that they've got services which are accessible and which are available to them, and that when they develop a relationship with a support worker or with somebody who's working alongside of them, that can be a longer term relationship because somebody's got a secure job and they're not having to sort of look to move around to support their own family. So I think secure funding for support services is really essential. Secondly, I think there is a need, as Marcia's mentioned, about training for professionals. Social workers definitely could do with more training, both during their initial professional training and on an ongoing basis, but so do other professionals such as teachers. If we're talking about children today, actually children spend most of their time outside of the family in a school environment or daycare, and how do we ensure that those professionals are alert to the experiences that children might be having outside of the school environment and think about how they respond to children in ways which are likely to be helpful. Doesn't mean that they have to engage in therapy, but they can do small things which probably mean an awful lot to those particular children in terms of being able to cope with the situation they find themselves in, let alone being able to move on from it. Thirdly, we've talked about sort of thinking about pivoting to the perpetrator. And I think that's good to sort of say that for professionals to put the focus on perpetrators about how they're going to change their behaviour. But we also need to have a greater range of ways of working with perpetrators. Some are amenable to being supported and trying to engage in changing their own behaviour, whilst others may not be. But for those who are amenable or who could be worked with, what are the range of options that we have to try and ensure that even if they end this relationship, they don't go into another relationship and just continue to behave in the same way with a different adult and child victims. And fourthly, I think the key thing in all of this, and Emily's talked about it so eloquently, is about how do we both protect and support the relationship between the child and the adult victim, most typically their mother, because I think that sort of the danger is that we go in and we have different professionals with a different focus. They're primarily there for the child or for the adult, and actually we don't think about the importance of that relationship between the child and the adult and think about not only how do we protect that, but actually how do we nurture that, both at the time that the abuse is happening, but also afterwards. And there's some great examples in Scotland of services that have been set up to do that. And again, it comes back to the first point, how do we make sure that those are available to more children and more mothers and a small number of fathers as well in ways which are going to be helpful for, as Emily said, to create that new normal.
I'm going to boot the final word. Oh, sorry, jump in, Marcia, come on.
Yeah, just because I meant to say this before and I forgot. So we know that the relationship, as John pointed out also, is that between the child and the non-offending parent is really important. So supporting that in whatever way we can do. So we've done lots of work with child survivors of domestic abuse and children, talking to children about what has helped them and what would have helped them more. And the single biggest thing, and it so strikes me, Emily, that it's the same thing you said when asked about what was the most important thing to you. And when you ask children, what's the single biggest way that we can help them? They say they want a trusted adult to support them, to speak for them sometimes in situations where they're not comfortable, or to help them speak for themselves, to explain what's going on in what is an enormously complicated and illogical sometimes systems, both criminal justice and social services. So, and we have passed the law. So in the Children's Scotland Act, you know, essentially the law says that any child involved with the criminal or civil justice system has a right to an advocate. And so when we talk to children, that's what they want. They want an advocate, a trusted adult who doesn't put another burden on their mother. And they described Grace, so that we have a great piece for social workers if they want to see it, about what that advocate looks like. But they described a children's worker in a Women's Aid. And I think that we need to not only keep in mind that women need their own support, but also that children thrive when you give them a safe space and a place to say what they need to say and then figure out who to say it to. So I would really just always like to point out that we have this in law, but we have not implemented it because of money.
Yeah.
So it is well past time that we started prioritizing children's needs in this.
Okay, Marcia. And I'm going to give the final word to you, Emily. You've lived it. You've survived it. You're talking about it now. What's your takeaway from today? Because it is wonderful to get the opportunity to get somebody from Scottish Women's Aid, an academic, and somebody who's a survivor in the same actual space and connect up those dots. But for you, what's been the big takeaway?
Yeah, I think it was John said earlier about we are making change. People are understanding things better. But as Marcia was also saying, training is ongoing. You know, there's always new technologies, there's new ways to abuse, the training is just constant. But it is really heartening to see that people are coming on board to understand it. And I think, you know, just as I mentioned earlier, to try and think of the holistic picture, you know, it's not just the incident that might be on the table that happened last Friday. It's the whole big picture. And also, you know, as John was saying there, how we move forward with that, how we ensure the children can thrive going forward. And I don't like the word recovery, but, you know, to make things better, to keep improving the situation and put supports in place that protect the mother and the children.
So a lot of work still to be done, some progress, but I hope we've shone a bit of a light on it today. I've learned an awful lot. So I'm really, really grateful to you all, to Emily, to John, and to Marcia. Thank you so much.